Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They were talking climate change, vital agreements at the G20 meeting in China this week. But the work of conservation and adaptation goes on every day at the ground level. My guest, Miriam Horn, has been talking with farmers, fishermen, ranchers in America's great Mississippi watershed about changes they're making on the front line. This hour on Point, the harvesters' view of climate change and conservation. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Who are the unsung heroes of conservation in your world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we will go to North Dakota to get an update on the Dakota Access Pipeline and the protests against it crossing the Missouri River that turned violent this weekend. But first, joining me from New York is Miriam Horn, author of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Miriam Horn leads special projects at the Environmental Defense Fund, a nonprofit environmental group that advocates for market-based solutions to environmental problems. Miriam Horn, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
You're talking with people working in quite a vast area of the United States, the Mississippi watershed. That's just about the whole guts of it here. And you went out to talk with people on the front lines, farmers, rancher, fishermen. Why there instead of Copenhagen or Paris or, you know, up where the big agreements are being made, Miriam?
Well, the Mississippi watershed is really critical to America's history and America's future. And it drains 40% of the United States. It's basically a big funnel right through the center of America. It's where everything from Lewis and Clark's journeys to the Civil War to Huck Finn's famous journey took place. And it's where most of our natural resources still come from. It's where we built ourselves as a global economic power on the timber and the minerals from those northern mountains and the grains and soybeans and meat from the Great Plains, and then down those rich coastal estuaries and the Gulf of Mexico produce much of our seafood. So it's critical to the future of our food supply and the global food supply and the future, really, of all of our natural resources.
We put it up against climate change, but you've got threats that are much more on the ground and immediate, not necessarily climate change related, that you cite here: overgrazing, overtilling, overfishing, invasive species development, and, yes, extreme weather. What led you to focus on these harvesters, as you call them, whether they're on land or water, who are right on the front line?
Well, I think that these are heroes that generally go overlooked in the United States. I mean, the Mississippi region in general goes overlooked, where many of us are guilty of flying over it rather than visiting it. But these are also people who often have lived for generations on the land. They know it in the way that you only can if you have that depth of experience. They love it in the way that you only can if all of your memories of your parents and your grandparents are tied up in the rituals of harvest and fishing. And they are also the ones who understand just how interdependent we are. Their livelihood every single day depends on the health of those soils and those forests and those rangelands and those wetlands. And so they're bringing this tremendous depth of knowledge and this tremendous depth of love to restoring those ecosystems, because their livelihoods depend on them, but because they also feel a greater sense of responsibility to the rest of the country and the rest of the world.
You know, I'm very sympathetic to this. I grew up on what's now a seventh-generation farm in the middle of Illinois, right in the heart of your Mississippi watershed. So this is very close and dear to me. And I know that it's not easy to step out of the kind of industrial agriculture system and become a big conservationist or find other ways, though the people on the front line can often see the importance of doing that when things come under pressure. We should begin to introduce us to the people that you spoke with for this book. And maybe we start far from the mouth of the Mississippi. It's 4,000 miles, I think, up in the Rockies, where you really spent some time with a rancher there, Dusty Crary. What's his environment? What's he finding he can do as one rancher to meet the challenges there?
Well, Dusty lives in what's called the Crown of the Continent. It's this glorious 10 million acres that goes from the Canadian border through Glacier down through some of the country's biggest wilderness areas and reaches out on both sides of the mountains into these protected ranches that have been there for generations and that have remained intact and that provide really critical habitat for animals like grizzlies that still in that crown of the continent, they still traverse the prairies. They come out of the mountains and into the prairies and back again. And Dusty was actually a rodeo champion when he was a young man. He was a saddle bronc, Montana State saddle bronc champion. And that led him to travel a lot around the country and to see what had happened to other communities like his that lived on that seam between mountain and prairies, and to see that the ranches were all gone. They'd all been cut up into suburban development. And so he went home really acutely aware of his desire to save. Montana calls it the last best place, and when you're up there, you can believe it. So he set about first working to protect his own family's ranch and then helping some of his neighbors protect their ranches and make that financially feasible to do. And then he worked with a very unlikely group of allies that ranged from the NRA to the Wilderness Society to protect several hundred thousand acres of public land as well, so that you get this giant continuous landscape that the wildlife can really roam as they always have.
One of the things that he's advocated for was the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act. You'll tell us what that is, but here's the sound of Dusty Crary, Montana rancher, promoting that. It was signed into law in December of 2014 by President Obama, designated Montana's first new wilderness in 31 years, many, many acres of wilderness, the Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex.
Well, I was born and raised here, and this is all I've ever wanted to do. You know, with this backdrop and the water and the wildlife that we have here, is a pretty nice place to do your business. We want this to stay the way it is. For my family, the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act, it really is our homeland security bill.
Montana rancher Dusty Crary talking there. He, I guess, gave a bunch of his or moved a lot of his family's ranch into a conservation easement. And you write in the book about how, you know, you had neighbors saying, you know, what the hell are you doing? You're giving away your kid's birthright, and saying, you know, at some point the invisible ink's going to dry and some greenie outfit's going to own your outfit and be calling the shots. He didn't see it that way.
No, Dusty really saw the conservation easement as a way to exercise his own private property rights. He could have made a choice. When he put his ranch into a conservation easement, the Nature Conservancy actually compensated him for the value that he gave up, the value that he could have secured if he'd carved that ranch up into ranchettes.
And what does he promise in return, Miriam, for that?
He promises that the ranch will never be divided in perpetuity, that it, no matter who inherits it or who buys it, they always have to keep that ranch an intact working ranch. And so it's been a really critical tool to keep these big, magnificent ranches intact across the country.
Take us all the way to the other end of the Mississippi. You talk with Sandy Nguyen, who with a Vietnamese refugee background, about the work that she and others do along the Gulf Coast there. Where does she find, you know, the line she wanted to make in the water or the sand on conservation?
Well, Sandy represents a community that is one of the most vulnerable in the country, though they have a lot in common with communities. With most of America now lives on coastlines that are in jeopardy. In their case, the wetlands that they survive on, these are Vietnamese and Cambodian refugees that survive by shrimping and harvesting oysters and crabs, all of which they harvest in those shallow waters, and all of which have the beginning of their life cycle in those wetlands. Louisiana has lost 2,000 square miles of wetlands, primarily because we re-engineered the Mississippi River in such a way that it no longer can build its own delta. It no longer can deposit all that wonderful mud that gave it its nickname into those wetlands and keep them intact against the erosive power of the Gulf. So Sandy's community is extremely vulnerable. They're losing the estuaries that sustain that seafood. They're also losing all of the protection that those wetlands provides them and New Orleans and America's largest oil and gas infrastructure. All of that has been protected by those wetlands, and it's now all exposed to the full force of the Gulf and these intensifying hurricanes. So she's trying to help her community navigate this very ambitious plan that Louisiana has developed to restore those wetlands using the Mississippi River again.
Is the sound from a trailer of a documentary based on Miriam Horn's book, Sandy Nguyen, talking about the generational divide she sees in Gulf fishermen.
The older fishermen, they actually witnessed the coast depleting, but the newer generation fishermen are the ones that have to deal with it.
And here, she says, she's advocating for mostly Vietnamese and Cambodian as well, but shrimp fishermen on the Gulf, working with fishermen and government together.
Historically, fishermen and government, it's not a mix there. But this is where I want to be, connecting everybody, and then move forward quickly to fix our coast.
Miriam, do your harvesters, whether on land or water, find they're the odd person out when they try and act on these things rather than just keep on farming or fishing in the same old way?
No, that was really one of the inspiring discoveries I made, was that they're not outliers at all. I went with Justin Knopf, my Kansas farmer, who we'll hear for in a little while, took me to a meeting he goes to every year in his town with other farmers who are trying to really protect soils and biodiversity in the way that he is. And there were close to 2,000 farmers in that room, really traditional farmers, probably like some of your ancestors in their overalls and their John Deere caps. Mm-hmm. These were traditional guys, but they were all really committed to this enterprise of, you know, a lot of them lived through the Dust Bowl. A lot of them are living through these intense droughts and these torrential rains. And so they're all in this together.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about ranchers, farmers, and fishermen and women stepping up to become lead conservationists in a time of big challenges to our land and sea. Miriam Horn writes about them in the Great Mississippi Watershed in her new book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. She joins us today from New York. We're going to go to Kansas in just a moment and get a report from there. Listeners, you can join us. Do we have to tackle conservation, these issues, at the level of each cornfield, fishing boat, range? Are you one of these people, these harvesters? What are you doing in your field or fishing grounds to make things better? Is it your job to save the environment? Miriam Horn joins us from New York. Adam is calling from Portland, Maine. Adam, you're on the air with Miriam Horn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I jumping from Ohio to Portland, I got to go to college at the College of Worcester in Ohio and study ethics and religion there and learn about farmland from people like David Klein and his book, Scratching the Woodchuck, and understanding our relationship with the environment and the world around us.
Yeah.
How that ties back into food, and came back to New England where I'm from and have been working at Bangs Island Mussels in Portland, Maine, where they focus on a biodiverse aquaculture, mussels being the main one, but kelp and scallops, and growing that biodiversity is extremely important. Now, what that leaves us with is Bangs Island Mussels, their mussels aren't really what people are expecting when they're going to the store to pick up fish. We've got this long history of tuna and swordfish, and raising that awareness of all these other kinds of foods out there, I think that transfers across the board, across the country, but raising that awareness for the types of food, there's an amazing ecosystem within the restaurant industry in Portland using local fish and the local mussels, but how we advance that awareness through the food that we eat and also ethically, the money that we spend, it transfers right back down to the way that it enhances the environment around us. And then through the sciences, like places like the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, injecting that money from your own pocketbook and then also from the government, it's top down and back and forth.
Hey, Adam, may I ask you, along the Maine coast there, do you find in others who are harvesting the coast or fishermen there, is the general attitude of these frontline harvesters, let's put conservation and environmental issues first, or is that secondary to making a living and maybe not even on their screen?
So you have to understand that the Gulf of Maine coast is huge, and the history of fishing there goes back centuries and centuries. And to be putting forward an aquaculture farm is something really relatively new and takes a very entrepreneurial spirit, because you have the old families who've been living on the same island for hundreds of years lobstering. And to them, this is a huge investment to change the way that they do things. And luckily, I got to work for a family who's getting into it, having been small lobstermen. They were able to really put a lot of money forward to do this. There's a wide range of opinions, people who want nothing to do with it, and then people like the Moretti family who are really making a jump. And the margins aren't as good right now for aquaculture, but if you're able to make that, there's a lot of people there and a lot of scientists who really want to make it happen and understand the enormity of the situation.
Adam, I appreciate your call from Portland, Maine. Miriam Horn, you looked along the Gulf Coast there, and I'm sure there's a range of opinion, whether it's, you know, shrimpers there or fishermen, or you get up into sort of the heart of the watershed where you've got corn and soybeans and different traditions and methods of farming there all the way up into the Rockies. Not everybody jumps on the conservation bandwagon. Some are just going for yield right now.
Well, you know, there are a lot of incentives that don't necessarily drive farmers to the best decisions or support them when they're trying to make these changes. And I think there are a lot of policy things that we could do to help farmers. Adam's right. These transitions can be really expensive and can take a lot of time. And so some of the work that Environmental Defense Fund, where I work, some of the work that they're focused on are getting both the market signals that he referenced, giving consumers real insight into how they can buy food in ways that support sustainable farming. So we're working with a partner that might seem terribly unlikely, Walmart, who has asked its food suppliers to ask their grain suppliers to give preference to farmers like Justin, who are doing work to prevent greenhouse gas emissions from their farm. So some of it is getting the market signals right to help these farmers have the financial support that they need to make these change, and some of it is getting some of the federal policies right so that we're not subsidizing destructive kinds of farming, and we are supporting really constructive kinds of farming.
It's not just cute little farms you're talking about. You go industrial scale as well with Justin Knopf and his family farm, fifth generation wheat farmer in Kansas. Here's a little bit from him. Again, a trailer for a documentary based on your book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. He talks about the scale of responsible farming that he's trying to do.
We're not a small organic farm. We're covering several thousand acres, so we're what some would call at a commercial scale. There's this perception that in order to take care of the environment, that you have to farm at a scale that my grandfather would have been farming on at the 1950s. And I think that's not quite accurate.
Not accurate. And what's his responsibility? What's his role? Is the guy actually on the land? Here he is again, Justin Knopf.
As a farmer, the natural resources are the most important thing to me. So we see it as the tools of creation that we've been given to work with on a daily basis. We're not just here to maximize production, forsaking the environment, because we don't have the luxury to be able to do that.
We don't have the luxury to do that, at least not over the longer term. Justin Knopf, a Kansas wheat farmer, joins us right now from Gypsum, Kansas. He is one of those profiled in Miriam Horn's new book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. Justin Knopf, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, Tom.
What all are you farming there, Justin?
Yeah, I farm with my dad and brother here, and we raise wheat, alfalfa, soybeans, grain sorghum, or some people call it milo, and a little bit of corn.
Fifth generation farm. How old are you now, Justin?
I am 38.
And what are you up to on the farm that puts you in the zone of interest to Miriam Horn? What makes you a conservation hero, sir?
Well, I kind of asked that same question, actually, initially, Tom. I think Miriam would vouch for that. I kind of argued with her that, you know, my story is repeated on many other farms across the Midwest. And, you know, in some regards, there are other farmers that are years ahead of me in this biological thought process and implementing on their farms. But you know, she was pretty persistent and kept coming back. And I think, you know, I think she was attracted to some of the things that we are doing just from a broader, just trying to have a broader perspective on how we think through and how we manage the landscape that we work with and the heritage that has defined that. And now that I've had an opportunity to kind of look through her whole work that she has really stitched together, she's done a nice job of making it pretty seamless of how it this ties together.
It's beautiful.
In our operation and others.
Yeah, it's beautiful storytelling. Take us to the evolution of the kind of farming you're doing over the last, I don't know, 5, 10 or more years, and the changes, Justin, that you see coming on stream that I guess we hope make our farming, even industrial farming, more sustainable.
Mm-hmm, sure. I think really at the ground level of it, it's a transition from looking at individual crops or individual decisions on their own, but trying to, rather than weigh through the individual decisions or crop management plan for a specific crop, it's more of thinking through the entirety or the totality and the bigger picture. So, you know, what we really are striving to look for in the decisions we make on a daily or monthly or annual basis, and when we do our planning and how we work with our land, is we're looking for the sweet spot, I would say, that maximizes, maybe not maximizes is the right word, that has a good, profitable economic return.
Mm-hmm.
That is has a good environmental return, a good environmental investment in restoring the resources that we're working with, and also a good social return for our families, our health and our well-being, our time, my brother and I's time with our kids, our young family, and the other members in our community. And so when we think through our how we want to manage our family farm, those are really the three overarching things that we try to look at from a holistic point of view to kind of navigate this course.
It can look pretty high tech. You're out there in your big combine with a computer screen with moisture levels flowing in and ambient temperature and humidity and pounds harvested each second. But how, as Miriam knows from being right there, but what changes have you made to make your commercial farming operation more conservationist in its profile?
Just really trying to learn and pay attention to more of the underlying biology of what's happening. So, for instance, you know, right now we have in our sorghum fields, this is perhaps an example, in our sorghum fields right now we have kind of a new pest to that crop in the last 3 years called the sugarcane aphid. And so right now our milo fields are going through the reproductive phases. They're producing grain. And so for your listeners who aren't familiar with what milo or grain sorghum is, it's a warm season grass crop. So
yep.
It looks similar to corn, but it's a little bit shorter in stature. And instead of making an ear halfway up the plant like a corn plant does, it actually produces the grain that we utilize at the very top of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So these little aphids have blown in from down south. They overwinter down in Mexico, and then once they land in our fields, they start reproducing very quickly. In fact, most of them are female, and they reproduce without mating and have offspring about every 3 days. And so the population blows up very quickly, and the problem that they cause on our plants out there trying to produce grain is they cover the plants with this very sticky substance called honeydew. And if you could imagine taking honey and spreading it very thin like dew, that's really actually what it would be like. And then the plants aren't able to produce as much photosynthesis and lose yield and leads to a lot of problems. So the first response, of course, is, well, let's go out and spray those things with a pesticide and get rid of those things. But
yep.
Rather than doing that immediately, we try to take a step back and look at the bigger picture and think about what's happening biologically here, where are our beneficial insects, and we try to monitor those levels and just wait first and see if biology, allow biology to work, which may not be as fast and may take some patience, but allowing that to the first opportunity to work before we come in and have to fine-tune the system with our own practices. So I think that's kind of an example right now in real time, but just trying to take a bigger look at the picture before making very quick, expedient decisions.
Before you just bring the chemical hammer down. Justin Knopf, stand by there in Kansas. And Miriam Horn, I want to bring it to you, but we've got lots of callers for the two of you as well. Molly in Loveland, Ohio. Molly, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think you really hit the nail on the head when you're emphasizing storytelling and these personal narratives reaching people who would not otherwise be impacted by land use change or climate change, and really individualizing the experiences of people. And there's actually a really historic initiative going on right now called the Permanent People's Tribunal. It's a descendant of the Vietnam War Crimes Tribunal, and they're collecting testimony from these families and individuals and communities that have been impacted by things such as oil and gas extraction, land use changes, to give their testimony into an international tribunal with a panel of judges who will be evaluating it and get it on the public record. And I just wanted to encourage your listeners to submit their testimony and look into it, because I think storytelling really is going to solve a lot of our problems or bring it to the light.
Molly, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. One more right here from the Mississippi watershed, Springfield, Illinois. Janelle, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Just calling because you're talking about watersheds. I hadn't heard anyone bring up anything about herbicides, specifically runoff from fields into waterways, the Mississippi, down the Gulf, and into the Gulf of Mexico, where we're seeing a lot of algae blooms and other issues, you know, just in local ponds and things. So I just like to hear maybe from some farmers or anyone that, what are the alternatives? What are we looking at, you know, for future? Why are we using so many herbicides? And I just haven't heard anything about that yet.
It's a great question, Janelle. I appreciate you raising it. Miriam Hart, let me bring it first to you at the Environmental Defense Fund. I'm sure you're focused on that, and you write about it in the book. But what did you find? Did you find reason for hope here among your conservation heroes on that front?
Well, certainly, and there are several kinds of chemicals that get put on a farm, and the chemical that actually, or the input that actually causes the algal blooms and the dangerous water pollution is fertilizer. It's nitrogen fertilizer, and that can be put on in the form of synthetic nitrogen, or it can be put on in the form of something like animal manure. And it is a tremendous problem, not only because it pollutes waterways and it pollutes municipal water supplies, but it does cause these algal blooms in the Gulf of Mexico that choke out life in an area the size of Connecticut. So farmers like Justin, and I'll let him tell his own story on this, but farmers are finding ways with the help of groups like ours, they're finding ways to be much more precise in their application of nitrogen, to really understand how much the plant or the field needs. They're getting to finer and finer granularity and applying only that much, because right now about half of the nitrogen that farmers apply to their fields is lost into the atmosphere as a very powerful greenhouse gas, or is lost into the waterways as a pollution. And obviously that's also a loss of money for them. So getting nitrogen applied in a really precise way is really critical to cleaning up the water supply. I mean, Justin, do you want to talk a little bit about how you do that, how you use plants to fix nitrogen in your soils?
Justin Knopf?
Yeah, certainly. I really appreciate that question. And it's a good question, something that, you know, we farmers are really thinking a lot about. We look at it a lot on our farm. She asked about herbicides and then also fertilizers. And so, you know, those things, from my perspective as a farmer, those things are very important tools to be able to do the best I can at maximizing every drop of rain and every acre of soil that we work with to produce the most yield and life-sustaining products from those resources. But they also cost money. They cost money, and I don't want to, you know, waste those. And also, I am living on the natural resources, the water, drinking the water here that we work with on a daily basis. So I have no interest in over-fertilizing or losing those things into the environment, or having what I would call a leaky system.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about ranchers, farmers, and fishermen stepping up to become conservationists in a time of big challenges to our land and sea. Miriam Horn writes about it in her new book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. She quotes Willa Cather in the front from O Pioneers, "The land belongs to the future. We come and go, but the land is always here, and the people who love it and understand it are the people who own it for a little while." Of course, it is only for a little while in the great sweep of what that land means. Whether it's always been true that they've been the best conservationists of that land, maybe an open question, but she's sought out those who are on land and on water in this book. One of them, Justin Knopf, is with us today from Gypsum, Kansas, fifth-generation wheat farmer there as well. We're talking about how to harvest with a light footprint on the earth, and it hasn't always been easy, often isn't right now, maybe isn't even done in many places. Justin, I'll come to you in just a second, but callers for you as well. Tony in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air, Tony.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I've grown up in the heartland of America my whole life, and I've been a hunter, fisherman, and, I've gathered mushrooms and blueberries and everything. And I've seen, incrementally just the riparian zones along the rivers and the CRP and the prairie of Nebraska disappear as, the development and as the technology in farming has allowed farmers to increasingly push into the edges. And it seems like the pervasive attitude in, that I've seen in Nebraska has been, plow it under to get in a few more rows of corn. We got to, the price of corn is down, so we need to make the extra few bucks.
Tony, I know exactly what you're talking about. And, of course, the whole center of the country that Miriam Horn's writing about has seen that for a long time. Justin Knopf, do you think farmers like yourself and in the main will really be friends of environmentalism here over time? Or is the push for yield always going to lean against that?
That's a really fair question. And I appreciate the caller's, perspective, what he's seeing up there around Omaha. And, I think the families that will be in this the long term have to have a long term approach. And in the short term is getting rid of some of those riparian zones and some of the things he's seeing going to allow that farmer to perhaps benefit a little bit economic in the short term? Arguably so, yes. But in the long term, the biological impact of that, I think, and the management of that will come back and diminish returns in the long run. And it's always discouraging to hear perspective of that, but I think there's also a lot. I think it's also important to recognize that there's a lot of things going on within the farming landscape that is very easy to miss. A lot of so we're using a lot of cover crops on our fields, and so in a place where 100 years ago or 200 years ago that may have been native prairie, it's now a farming landscape, but we're implementing and adding things, more diversity back into that farming landscape, that even though it doesn't look like a native prairie did five, six generations ago, we are moving back the other direction on our farm and many farms. Certainly not every farm, but certainly many farms are moving back, I think, the other direction toward a more restorative perspective, because again, I think when we think about long-term sustainability and staying power over generations, which farmers historically have done pretty well at, if you abandon and destroy the resources that we work with, your long-term sustainability becomes impossible real fast.
Miriam, what's your sense of where the balance is here between those who you call heroes who are out there working on conservation and those who are maybe not even, you know, individuals, but just big corporate farm operations just looking for to maximize their yield and profit off the land, may not put conservation first at all, though, as Justin says, everybody has to at some point if you want a long-term healthy relationship with that land. What's the dominant ethic out there right now, Miriam?
Well, I think it actually is changing, as Justin suggests, and that's in part thanks to land-grant colleges like K-State, where Justin went to school, which is not, they're not only training young farmers like Justin to really understand the microbiology of the soil and how absolutely essential it is to support that. They're doing really important research that to support farmers like Justin. I mentioned some of the changes that are coming from the market side, that some of the changes that consumers are managing to push. The meeting that I mentioned earlier about no-tilling, one of Justin's big innovations is that he has, while his mother's family, which settled the farm right after the Civil War, homesteaded it, and they, for generations, they plowed the soil every year, and they got to a narrower and narrower set of crops, and every year they had this clean, disked, beautiful tilled soil, but in doing so, they really depleted all of the organic matter and fertility and carbon in that soil. And it's a story that Justin really has faced up to, and as he says, is really, he understands why they made those choices at the time, but now is committed to restoring it and has at his disposal all kinds of tools that he didn't have before.
And farming without plowing and without doing all that big turnover and getting the soil loss that comes after.
Exactly. So he can leave his soil physically protected by leaving the stubble and the residues from previous crops on there so that it doesn't get eroded in the way that it did during the Dust Bowl, and it doesn't get eroded under these new torrential rains, and that the microbial ecology in the soil can really thrive. It can stay undisturbed, and it can sustain this incredible diversity that we don't even begin to understand, the thousands of species and trillions of organisms that really are the foundation of all of our well-being. So right now, the best numbers that the USDA has are that about 20% of farmers in the heartland are moving to no-tilling all the time, to leaving those soils undisturbed. That's an indication of, Justin mentioned, cover cropping. There's growth in cover cropping every year. More and more of those farmers are getting the kind of support they need from institutions like K-State and from the market and from federal policy. So I'm optimistic about the direction it's going. It is a big ship to turn around.
Justin, it's a big industry. Overall, are you optimistic that conservation-minded farmers, family farms or corporate, you name it, are going to be steering this by and large or not?
Yeah, I am optimistic, Tom. You know, when I look across my own community here in central Kansas, when I compare the landscape to what it looked like 10 or 15 years ago, it looks much different. There's much more green growing throughout the entire year. There's much less open tilled soil that's susceptible to loss and erosion, and a lot more diversity in cropping, and more responsible use of fertilizer and a lot of it. I really appreciate Miriam talking about Kansas State and the land grant system throughout the U.S. because a lot of education and research that's being done, and working with farmers to improve those practices and help them understand. And it really closes. Miriam mentioned the no-till farming, leaving cover on the soil and allowing that biology habitat to thrive. That really closes the loop on the caller from earlier asking about fertilizer and allowing that biology to thrive. And in these cropping rotations, we're using legumes that plants that produce their own nitrogen and then release that nitrogen back into the soil biologically. And the soil, of course, is the foundation to all of this work and the healthy, alive system that exchanges that fertility and those nutrients for those crops. The more healthy it is, the healthier, and it exchanges that. And so that really closes the loop on some of the things we're doing to reduce the amount of fertilizer that that we're able to use with maintaining our productivity and our economics and social return.
Justin Knopf in Gypsum, Kansas, fifth generation wheat farmer there. Justin, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Great to have you here. And Miriam Horn, author of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. Thanks for all your stories from up and down the Mississippi watershed. Thank you so much, Miriam.
Thank you, Tom. A great pleasure.
In a moment, protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is On Point. On Saturday, protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline turned violent after private security used pepper spray and unleashed dogs on several hundred protesters there. The $3.8 billion oil pipeline is under construction, will travel under the Missouri River and near the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Reservation if it's completed. Protesters are concerned that the pipeline will destroy American Indian burial grounds and pollute potentially drinking water. Joining me now from Bismarck, North Dakota, is Amy Sisk, reporter for Prairie Public Radio and for Inside Energy Now. Amy Sisk, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What exactly is this pipeline designed to do?
Yes, so the Dakota Access Pipeline, it's a 1,200-mile pipeline. It's slated to carry about 500,000 barrels of oil per day from the Bakken oil fields of western North Dakota to Illinois.
500,000 barrels a day, okay.
Yes. Yep. And to put that into context for you, North Dakota produces about 1 million barrels of oil per day, so it would have the capacity to take about half of North Dakota's daily crude output.
Who's protesting it?
Good question. A number of people are protesting it. Here in North Dakota, we have, thousands of Native Americans who have come from all over the country to show their solidarity and opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. They're joining the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which is in southern North Dakota here, where the pipeline would cross under the Missouri River right next to their reservation. Now, the Native Americans are also joined by a number of environmental groups that are also opposing the pipeline.
And what exactly are the fears or complaints that they've raised that have them out protesting?
Yes. So the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is particularly concerned about the potential for a leak under the Missouri River crossing. They're concerned that if oil were to leak from the pipeline in that particular spot, it would contaminate their drinking water, which they draw from the Missouri River. Now, they're also concerned about the impact a spill would have or the impact that construction on the pipeline will have on sacred sites, you know, such as burial grounds.
What's the state of the pipeline right now? How much of that 1,200 miles is already built, and where does construction stand?
Yeah, so construction began on this pipeline this spring in all four states that it crosses. It crosses North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I know that construction is at least 20% in most of those states. I think in some it's significantly more. So construction is definitely underway, but it's not completed yet.
So this is about bringing oil from the Bakken oil fields down into the Illinois area. This is not about tar sands out of Canada. Is that right? We know pipeline systems can all interconnect, but this is not about the sort of a roundabout way of doing Keystone?
No, this is different than Keystone, though there definitely are some similarities in the fight against it. So the Keystone XL pipeline would have transported about 800,000 barrels of oil per day from the Canadian tar sands in Alberta into the United States, where it would then be processed at refineries. We're talking here about oil from the Bakken oil fields of western North Dakota, so it is a different fight.
Does the pipeline company have all its permits in order? Is this thing just rolling ahead, or is there some legal question about that now?
Yes, so the pipeline company has secured permits from all four states' public service commissions that this pipeline crosses through, as well as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which has jurisdiction over this pipeline's waterway crossings. Now, there's a legal battle that's brewing over this pipeline with regard to the waterway crossings. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe here in North Dakota has sued the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers trying to stop this pipeline from crossing at the Missouri River next to the reservation.
Where does the legal question stand then at the moment? Might it still be stopped, or who's considering?
Yeah, good question. So a judge is actually expected to rule later. A federal judge is expected to rule by Friday on whether to grant the tribe's request for an injunction to halt construction at that Missouri River crossing here. And so we'll know more Friday. But the judge yesterday actually issued another ruling related to the tribe's request to halt construction around the Missouri River Crossing area. Now, that judge yesterday, basically the two sides reached an agreement, and the judge's order is that agreement. So construction has to stop and a portion of that area, but not in another nearby portion where the tribe is concerned that its burial grounds are being disturbed.
Amy, what's
this? And that order will extend until Friday when the judge issues this order on this preliminary injunction.
What's the scene there where the protests are centered? And what's the scene look like? And what happened over the weekend, Amy?
Yes. So if you were to travel to the border, the north border of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, you would see that there's several camps that have been set up where people are essentially living. These camps really grew in size about a month ago, and they've had anywhere from a couple hundred people there at one time to a couple thousand people. So there's people living in tents, people living in teepees, people cooking food. There's actually a school that's even been set up there for the kids and school starting.
We just got a minute. Over the weekend, there was some kind of tussle that broke out, some kind of violence. What happened?
Yes. So not at the Missouri River crossing, but nearby on private land. The pipeline company was doing some construction there. The tribe had recently surveyed that particular land at the invitation of the landowner and concluded that there were some burial sites there as well as other sites sacred to the reservation. So a number, when the pipeline company was doing the construction there this weekend, a number of protesters broke through a fence, and several hundred protesters confronted some of the construction area, where they were met by some private security guards that were hired by the pipeline company, as well as guard dogs. And both security guards and the dogs were attacked, as well as the protesters. Some of them experienced dog bites.
We'll be watching for that judge's ruling on the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's good to know what's going on there. Amy Sisk, reporter for Prairie Public Radio in Fargo, North Dakota, and for Inside Energy Now. Thank you very much for being with us from Bismarck, North Dakota today. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Listeners, thanks very much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.